Many thanks, Vicente, for the introductory words. Good evening, Mr. Tirol, for being kind enough to come here to present your, to discuss about your book, which really is so comprehensive and broad in topics that it's going to be a challenge to pick up a few issues to discuss for just 60 minutes. And I'll try to do my best. And so before we enter into the typical issues which have been the familiar area of your research on industrial policy, network externalities, and the like, let's cover the more general issues, political issues that you deal with in your book. And particularly, you make a number of times the point that we need to be understanding with politicians because they live in a difficult world and they have to deal with citizens. And one of the problems for politicians is that citizens are not as rational as one could wish. And they are homo psychologicus, and there are a number of biases, and then politicians need to take into account that bounded rationality of voters in crafting the policies. Could you elaborate a bit on that? Because probably it's very, very, very important.
Well, first of all, I should thank you, Manuel, for doing this and exchanging with me, and of course, the Foundation, Rafael Del Pino, for hospitality, and Torres for publishing the book. That's a good question, how we deal with politics. It's true that it's difficult to be a politician because you have your own incentive scheme, which is basically being elected or re-elected the next time, and therefore you have to pander to the electorate and pander to the lobbies, otherwise you won't be re-elected. So my own view now is that we need the electorate to be more informed about economic issues. And the issue, of course, is that we all free ride as citizens because our vote individually do not count, and we are not well informed. And on top of that, as you mentioned, we have our own biases. So often we don't see the indirect consequences of policies. So we just look at the direct effects of, for example, a rent control policy as nice effect because the people who are renting a flat actually are paying less, but then there is the indirect effect that the supply of rentals is going to shrink, and of course the others won't have access to rents, to rentals of good quality and good price, so that's one of the things. There's also the issue of what people want to believe, and that's actually very important. For example, we have a natural tendency actually to ignore that, an accident could occur to us or to our family. We want to think it's never going to happen. And it's a little bit the same with economics. So we don't want to think that an increasing debt might jeopardize our social welfare system or that climate change is not going to be solved and that we have to pay a cost in order to reduce pollution. That's the kind of belief that politicians are confronted with. And of course, they take that into account and they try not to have messages which are sort of as gloomy. And conversely, the economists often come in and say, look, we're not going to solve climate change like this. We are not going to, we may have problems with the budget or with the debt. And at that point of time, of course, our welfare system might be jeopardized. And they are bearers of bad news. And that's part of the difficulty of being an economist is that we are bearers of bad news.
Yeah. Well, actually, you mentioned that sometimes economic policies backfire. The road to hell is paved with well intentions. You actually mentioned the problem of control of rents. But you mentioned in your book another interesting case, which might be interesting here in Spain. You say that the policy of having low fees for universities is counterproductive and actually works against the interest of low-income people because it's an indirect subsidy to the wealthy people in the society. Could you expand a bit?
I think more generally it's the entire system. It's not only the fees, but the entire system, at least in France. I cannot speak for Spain.
It's the same.
It's going to be a global disclaimer. But I think the whole system is actually what I call an insider trading system. It's in the sense that the people who are knowledgeable about how the system works do very well in France. Actually, if you look at the top 20% of their generation in terms of education, they do extremely well. And then, but if you look at the bottom, that's a quite different picture. And money is only one part of it. I mean, clearly, higher education at Polytechnic or Normal Sup and all those things actually are a subsidy to the bourgeoisie, clearly. I mean, there's a big subsidy. We know it's difficult because if you charge tuition, which gets rid of this subsidy to the richer classes, you also have to have a good system of scholarships, which are going to allow access to learning, to higher learning, to students who don't have the means to pay for that. So it's a difficult issue. What I'm sure of is that the system of education in France is very unequal and actually favors the people who are knowledgeable and the people who have a means to be in the right neighborhoods and do go through the right track.
Yeah. Well, actually, one of the beauties of your book is, even though it's focused on France, actually applies 100% to Spain, from what I've read. And particularly you say, for instance, that in France, only 36% of citizens support and trust markets, as compared to more than 60 in the US. Probably if in France you are 36%, probably in Spain are 20 in the 20s. And of course, that creates distrust for market and the demand, political demand for protection from politicians. You recall that Lionel Jospin was haunted by the sentence he uttered once that say, "Well, we cannot do anything. Sorry, we cannot fight the markets." So that's another constraint that probably the expectations of citizens are excessive, and politicians cannot deliver on so many desires.
And that's particularly true today with populist movements, because they promise an economy without constraint, where you can do lots of things by spending public money on various things. And we see that in France with the second round, where one of the candidates is promising basically a huge public deficit and doesn't have the policies to go with it. So the people actually are afraid. They are very scared by many things today. They're upset, of course, about the financial crisis, and we can understand why. They are worried about unemployment. They are worried about the future changes in employment due to the digital revolution. They are worried about debt, the debt of the state, which in many countries is getting very high and is threatening the welfare system. Many, many things are happening, and climate change, of course. And therefore, they are looking for some brighter picture. And the brighter picture is brought by populists, because the populists have no constraint and they can offer lots of free goods somehow. And that's part of the thing that that is worrisome in almost every country in the world.
Hmm. Well, one of the things of the book is that there are scattered many, many remarks on many different topics, including the question of culture, ethnicity, diversity, and on diversity, cultural diversity and ethnic diversity, you make two very interesting points. The first one is that in the presence of linguistic and cultural diversity, the links of solidarity between citizens are somewhat weakened, and that's a constraint. And there is another one on religion, which I will raise immediately, which struck me.
It's true that economists have found that there is less redistribution when there is more distance between the citizens. So, for example, in the US, in local communities, if people are of a similar ethnic or religious background, they tend to redistribute a lot among themselves, have lots of welfare programs and good schools. When there are divisions and there is heterogeneity, people are more selfish, of course. They tend to be nice to the people who are close to their community in some way. And that also arises in Europe, of course. It's one of the drawbacks of Europe is that we have people with different languages, different cultures. Even so, we might think we have the same culture by and large. But, we have to face it. And, every discussion, about bailouts, about stimulus, and so on, it's always about what's in it for me, in a sense. And, there's something to be said in favor of that, but still it's harder actually to have some consensus on basically some sharing, because beside moral hazard, which is very present in Europe, there's also some solidarity. If you look at the US among states, actually there's a lot of systematic redistribution among the states. It's not only an insurance mechanism, some kind of stabilization. So if California does poorly, New York is going to pay for it in some way, and that's true. because you have automatic fiscal and social security stabilizers. But on top of that, it can be systematic. So you know, there are states like the Louisiana or Puerto Rico who get systematic transfer. But there's this sense of belonging to the same community, which is the United States, that we don't, unfortunately, have yet in Europe. Hmm.
And concerning culture, as I was saying, and religion, you mentioned research, which I found interesting, saying that Jews are particularly adept and qualified because the learning of the Torah, the religious text, forces them to study intensively, including mathematics, which is part of the... There are many arithmetic problems in the Torah, for whoever is familiar with that book. And that sort of alternative explanation to Schumpeter's idea about the effect of Protestantism on market economies.
So the religion, economics of religion, and is actually a very interesting field of study. Of course, we economists, we don't talk about the comparative merits of religion. We study things we can study where we have some comparative advantage. So actually, Adam Smith, a long time ago, actually worked on the incentive of priests, because Adam Smith was saying, you know, if you are paid by your community as a priest, then you'll have incentive to be good and actually work hard for the community, whereas if you just get some money from the taxpayer or from the crown, you won't work as hard. So just a moral hazard situation. But then there are explanations also in terms of why economic communities, religious communities, I'm sorry, may do better than others. And there are two examples. For example, the one you mentioned, there is a whole Max Weber story about Protestantism, but there is also this thing about, and it's due to Maria Stella Botticini and Zvi Eckstein. You know, traditionally, the fact that Jews are doing better is attributed to the fact that they were chased, kicked out of some profession, and they moved to professions that turned out to be more advantageous. So it was pure luck in a sense. But they collect evidence showing that happened way before that. And, you know, the reading of the Torah actually made people literate. So when you move from an agricultural society to there were new jobs to be created where you had to be literate, then being a Jew was an advantage. Another example is that I have a colleague, a young colleague in Toulouse, Mohamed Saleh, who works on how the poll tax changed the composition of communities. If you remember, the Egypt in the 7th century before 640 was a Coptic country by and large. There were a few Christians, other Christian forms of Christians, and a few Jews, but by and large it was a Coptic country and there was no Muslims. So in 640 there was a Muslim invasion, and the Muslim did in Egypt what they did elsewhere, to have a poll tax. So if you wanted to stay Copt, you had to pay every year a tax. Consequence of that, of course, the people who remain Copts were actually the richest people, as you might imagine, because they could afford the tax, and they were also the most religious people. And basically, you had a selection, and compared to the Muslim minority, which became a Muslim majority, the Copts were doing very well in terms of economics, because they were the rich people, the educated people, who remained Copts, and the poor Copts actually converted to Islam. So those are examples, actually, and there are lots of other studies, and this is not my field of study, but it's actually very interesting to see how religions, for example, compete, how they provide public goods. You know, in many countries, they substitute for the state. And, you know, all kinds of things which are very interesting to study from the point of view of economics, but we have to stay humble, because, of course, on a purely religious ground, of course, we have nothing specific to say, but we can talk a little bit about the socioeconomic consequences of religion, about the incentives, about the competition among religions to get people to convert.
Well, to bring to an end this first chapter on the challenges of economic policy in a democracy, You make a very strong case for independent authorities, independent regulatory agencies like those you have in France, but at the same time you say, and it's also true in Spain, that there is a sort of political backlash against that concept because people consider that that goes against the grain of democracy. At the same time, you consider that Parliament should be able to impeach for a qualified majority those who really deviate. I suppose that's not very popular in France.
No, actually, at almost every election, we have some of the main candidates, sometimes all the main candidates, basically saying we are going to take away the independence of the ECB, basically trying to regain democratic control over the central bank. Of course, some of those know that it's never going to happen, but some of those are also sincere, and they very strongly believe that we should not have independent authorities dealing with monetary policy, dealing with competition policy, dealing with many other things. And actually, the lack of democracy, and maybe I'm going to shock some people, is actually what motivates independence and turning toward independent agencies. So before, there are some people in the room who actually are specialists of competition policy. Being independent allows you to go after firms who actually try to monopolize industries or engage in abuses of dominant positions. And that was much harder to do when it was in the ministry, because you could just, if you were a CEO, you could just call a friend in the ministry, the minister, and say, why don't you stop this nonsense? But if you have an independent agency, you cannot do that. And same thing for the central banks. The day we had a central bank which was independent, basically inflation was tamed. And that's coming back, because one of the candidates of the French election in the second round actually is proposing to have a non-independent central bank and having a big public deficit financed by printing money, which will be terrible for the economy, and on top will be terrible for the poor, which cannot protect themselves against inflation. But of course, nobody knows that. And the basic argument is, makes a lot of sense if you don't think about it. Why can we have such an important institution which doesn't depend, is not under democratic control? But the problem is that basically, if it's under democratic control, then it's going to do all kinds of things we don't want to have, and that's something we have to think about. But again, as you said, an independent agency is never completely independent. It should not be, actually. But the important thing is that on a particular issue, the politician should not be able to intervene, because that protects them in a way from the lobbies.
Well, let's move now to global warming, climate change, which has a chapter, a full chapter in the book, and you essentially criticize the Paris Accord, even though it was reached in Paris in December 2015, and you don't like this voluntary approach. You call it l'auberge espagnole, in which voluntarily you bring whatever you have to the place. But there are no binding constraints.
What was the translation of this?
Well, I was trying to find out how to... Well, anyway, and you advocate a cap and trade or a taxation system for carbon.
Okay, so the first thing is, it's true that I was a bit upset by COP21 in Paris. I think COP21 has the right diagnosis, in a sense. It says we should basically make sure that we don't emit too much carbon and we stay under 1.5 to 2 degrees Celsius warming. We should have transfer to the poor countries, because otherwise we won't get them on board. Everything is fine, with one caveat, which is we were saying the same thing in 1992. And no politician went back home saying, now we are going to do something about climate change. We are going to spend money to fight climate change. They all went back home saying, we won't. And the basis for this argument is that there is a collective promise. There's a collective promise to keep global warming under 1.5 to 2 degrees Celsius, and also to give 100 billion euros, or dollars in that case, to developing countries. But it's entirely collective. Who's going to give those 100 billion euros a year? Nobody knows. Everybody thinks it's going to be the others. Who's going to make the efforts to fight global warming? Nobody knows. I mean, there are some vague commitments, but they are not real commitments, and they are voluntary pledges. Is that efficient? I don't know. And it's true that, you know, in between there has been the election of Donald Trump, so it makes things even more complicated. But I think we are way behind in terms of the policies that could be used in order to fight global warming. But for that, it's a global problem. We cannot just have some partial thing. We need everybody to commit. Now, what should we do? And the economists will say we need to tax carbon in some way. There are two ways, actually, of doing that, at least two ways. One is to have a carbon tax, say, of 50 euros per year, per ton, I'm sorry, of carbon. The other one is to have a cap and trade system, and the cap and trade system will work in the following way. Under a cap and trade system, we will look at the carbon budget. The carbon budget is how much we can still emit in order to remain under this limit of 1.5 degrees Celsius. And then we will have a number of permits which will correspond to the carbon budget. And then we will make countries accountable for that. So you will be giving permits to different countries, but that's the issue of equity and fairness. We give them to whom, but we create a market, and by creating a market, we recreate a price. And then if you have a price of, say, 50 euros per ton of carbon, what's going to happen is that those who can abate, reduce their pollution by at cost of 10 euros, they will do so. But those for whom it costs 1,000 euros, they won't do so. They will just buy a permit or use one of their permits. And that's a way of getting efficiency. And efficiency is very important because it's going to be expensive, contrary to what the politicians say. You mean, green growth, we will have done it already, right? If we could grow by being green, we would be really stupid not to do it, right? And the point is that we have to be green, but we have to accept the cost. And if this cost is too high, then everything will be derailed. The lobbies will step in, the population will step in and say, we don't abide by our commitment. So we need to do things efficiently.
Yeah, and actually, you advocate the coalition between the five main blocs, the US, European Union, China, Russia, and India, getting together, reaching an agreement, and imposing a border tax adjustment to imports from those countries, not imposing that tax. But assuming that's not a realistic alternative in the medium term, what should the European Union do? Should we go along, even if that, as you yourself say, entails some delocalization of industries towards those countries which are not taxing carbon?
Well, that's a difficult issue, of course, because
that's for politicians.
Well, it's a difficult issue because we know we should be doing more in Europe. But at the same time, if we do more, there's a danger. Until now, the prices of carbon were quite low. So as long as the price of carbon in Europe are low, you don't delocalize, you don't move your factories abroad, you don't import too many goods which are produced in carbon-emitting countries. But when you start at a serious price, 50 euros, 100 euros, then you have the risk of our industries leaving and going to countries in which you don't tax carbon. And that's going to be a big issue. So here we are in a dilemma. We know we do way too little, but if we do more, there's danger that actually we are not going to combat emissions very well because the emissions will take place somewhere else. So that's actually a very difficult issue, and it's a global issue. So a country, or even Europe, just cannot do it on its own. It can do a few gestures trying to show signal it intends to do well, and it should do so, but you know, it's only limited what it can do.
Let's move now to unemployment. And you describe the French labor market, and it's almost identical, I would say, to the Spanish labor market. And you advocate ideas which have been discussed extensively here in Spain. And you make a very forceful case for reforms, and you insist on the need to protect the workers, not jobs. That's a refrain which comes up many times throughout your book. Why don't you elaborate a little on that?
Well, maybe we should remind people. I mean, of course, in Spain, I don't have to tell you how costly unemployment is. But first, it's very unfair. It's a very dual labor market in Spain or in France, with basically people who have permanent jobs and people who have short-term jobs and are laid off and then unemployment and then short-term jobs and so on. Second cause is long-term unemployment, which is big in Spain and in France, and it's kind of a disaster because it's more costly than short-term unemployment. And then there are all the hidden costs, because we see the, you know, the direct costs, but then the hidden costs, which is people don't move enough, so there's a bad matching of jobs to to workers. There is the lack of training. People stay in their, those who have short-term jobs, they don't get training because, of course, they will be laid off by their employer. And there's a cost of the first one is a malaise cost, which is that, you know, in France, and I'm sure it's the same in Spain, if you're not happy about your job, you still stay in your job because you think that you are not going to find a similar job elsewhere. So you might want a new challenge, you are fed up with your boss, you would like to move somewhere else, but you don't, you stick to your job. So that creates a malaise, including with those who are privileged, in quote, who have a permanent job. And then there is a cost for the public finances, which is very big because we spend a lot of money in France. And as long as we had a low debt, that was fine. But you know, now the debt is rising. Mm. And at some point, the cost of labor market policies may be too high. I should say another thing before we move on to protecting the worker, is that we now face a perfect storm. The perfect storm is the fact that, as I said, the public money is running out. We cannot spend so much money on labor market policies because we won't have this money anymore. Countries like France are highly indebted on balance sheet and off balance sheet. So that's going to be a first difficulty which didn't exist before, because we could always smooth things by spending a little bit more public money. And that was right to spend it, but you know, still that's an issue. Then there's a digital revolution. So what's going to happen is that the jobs change faster and faster over time, at a speed which is going to make it very difficult to adjust. Now, if we have very rigid job and we protect the jobs, that means it's going to be difficult because now jobs are going to disappear, you know, very quickly. And we are going to be in a situation where countries like France and Spain are going to protect the jobs. But the jobs are going to disappear. And the firms are going to go bankrupt if you keep on like this. So at that point of time, we'll have to react. And the final danger, but it's more remote, is immigration, because with global warming, at some point, there will be also a lot of immigration. Now, immigration is a chance. I mean, that's something that we have to realize. Actually, migrant workers actually can make the country much richer if you find jobs for them. And that's the important thing. In France, migrant workers is a difficulty, of course, because the job market is so close to, I mean, it's close to them. You don't find, they have a very hard time finding a job, and actually even their children have a hard time finding a job because of the labor market institution. So with that, of course, it's more difficult to welcome them. But in a country where you have decent labor market institutions, migrants are a chance, not a cost. And that's something that people don't realize.
Yeah, provided you overcome this fallacy that you discuss of the fallacy of the fixed pie, of the fixed quantity,
yes, exactly,
of work. Because otherwise you see migrants as competitors, and yeah, you fail to realize that migrants,
exactly,
create demand, and so the overall pie grows.
I mean, every time, you know, it's a, economists have this jargon, lump of labor fallacy, but basically thinking that work is in fixed quantity is actually a big mistake. It may be in fixed quantity in a very, very short run, because the capacities are fixed, and then you have orders and so on. But you know, by and large, you know, all the experiments which have been run, if you have a labor market which is open to migrants, actually they don't take the jobs of local people. They bring their knowledge, they pay social security contribution, they pay taxes, and actually they have a chance. And you know, when I see those populist movements who actually are playing with this lump of labor fallacy, I'm very worried. Just to take the election next Sunday, one of the candidates is actually falls into that trap with lump of labor fallacy. So that candidate, I can say she is proposing actually to stop migration to France. She's trying to stop the imported goods because they are taking her jobs. And then she wants earlier retirement. So earlier retirement means that, of course, more jobs will be created for the French. And you know, this is just wrong. This is just wrong economics. And I think we should not be making this mistake, but it's all over the place. I mean, we see it with Donald Trump. We see it everywhere. It justifies, you know, protectionist policies. It justifies all kinds of xenophobia. It's a wrong road.
Yeah. By the way, we were not supposed to be talking about politics, even though you have already disclosed your colors to some extent. But you make a very interesting remark in the book about the need for economies not to be politically independent, to be influential. Because if you are seen as aligned with any political party, automatically your social influence goes down.
I think let me put it like this. I've been always very cautious of not taking any political stance. I don't mind if other economists take political stances. It's my own character that I like to be more independent. I violated it with a recent election just because I think it's a very dangerous state for France. But I try to stay away from politics, which is not easy when you do economics, because of course you discuss things which have a political content immediately. But I'm very worried about labeling. So, you know, you might be a liberal, you might be a Keynesian, you might be a right wing, a left wing, you might belong to this school of thought and this other school of thought. But in the end, if you are a researcher, an intellectual, you have to be independent, you have to think by yourself and not tell you what the political party or this school of thought tells you. You have to be completely independent. And the danger is that if you are labeled in some group somehow, people don't listen to you, to what you have to say. They say, oh, you are saying that because you have those political opinions, or you are saying that because you are part of the Keynesian school. And that's a danger. I prefer to stay away from that. I'm not saying I'm right. Honestly, I'm not saying I'm right, and there are some people who take a political position. That's not my.
Well, and coming to an end to the discussion of unemployment, you make two proposals as part of your reform package, which may resonate here in Spain. The first one is to almost do away completely with temporary contracts, or limit them to genuinely temporary jobs, but not to roll over contracts all the time. And you also say that typically companies should be penalized through a bonus-malus scheme when they fire people, and the revenue from those taxes should be used to diminish social taxes for all companies, including those who have a permanent fixed labor force.
No, you describe things very well. So I don't like fixed-term contracts because they are very unstable. You get laid off, even so your employer likes you, and then you don't get any training, and then it's very expensive for the social security system because then you go through an unemployment spell. So fixed-term contracts are very bad contracts. Permanent contracts are also very bad contracts for other reasons, and I think we should need something which is open-ended, but has more flexibility than permanent contracts. Because right now there are two bizarre things in Spain, like in France. The first is that you put a labor court, in charge of deciding whether a layoff is justified or not. The problem is that the labor court doesn't have the information to decide, because it's only the employer who knows whether this job is useful or not for the company. So the employer doesn't have the employer does have the information, but the labor court doesn't. So I don't know how it is in Spain, but in France it's kind of random. You choose because you just don't know whether this layoff is justified or not. So just letting a court decide is very strange. And the second bizarre thing in France is that the people who lay off workers don't pay anything. They pay something to the worker, but they don't pay anything to the social security system, even so part of the cost. There's a big cost, actually, of laying off people because they are going to be unemployed and they're going to get unemployment benefits and retraining and all those things. And those are the firms which keep the workers actually are paying for those who are actually laying off the workers. It's completely upside down. And you know, in terms of the pollution analogy, you say it's the firms that that don't pollute actually who pay for the firms that pollute. It's completely crazy. So what we suggest with Olivier Blanchard, we suggested a long time ago, is actually to have this bonus-malus reward penalty system where the firms which lay off workers actually will be paying to the social security system, and then that will reduce the social security contribution of those who are virtuous enough to keep the workers. So that will align the incentive much better. That will be making the firms more accountable for their decisions. Because, of course, when they lay off a worker, there's an externality on the worker, but there's also an externality on society as a whole. And the firms should be internalizing this, just that, in the same way as they should be internalizing for the pollution.
Well, apologies to the audience, because we need to move to another interesting topic, Europe and the euro. And you make two remarks which struck me. First of all, you say that the banking union is an embryo of a federal union. And second, and most interesting here in Spain, you say that the, talking about the real estate bubble in Spain, you say that the Spanish catastrophe could have been avoided if a banking union had been in place at the time.
So the story there is that I've always been in favor of centralized supervision at the European level, and I should explain why. I have a caveat first, is that we don't know exactly how it's going to work. The jury is still out on the ECB supervision of banks. But at least it has two benefits. The first is to have more expertise. So it's easier to have expertise at the European level than in 27 or 28 countries, because you have to compete with banks, and banks have very sophisticated people, and there is asymmetry of information between the regulator and the bank. So the regulator needs to have people who are highly qualified in order to supervise the banks. So that's one advantage of centralizing things. But another advantage, and that's what you have in mind, is that you remove regulation away from politics, local politics. So formally, the regulation, and again, I don't want to talk about Spain because I may be saying something stupid, but you know, formally the regulation was the level of the Banca de España, but the Banca de España actually had worried about the real estate bubble. But the politicians, just like in the US, George Bush, just like in Ireland, they wanted to encourage home ownership, they wanted the construction sector to flourish. So for political reason, they wanted to go further with the real estate bubble. And there's a chance, at least, I cannot say it will have happened, but there's a chance at least that if it had been done in Frankfurt, and the Frankfurt people could have actually asked the banks to downsize and stop investing in the real estate bubble, then that could have stopped it. Whereas in Spain, it was not stopped with the consequences for the people, which was
pretty bad. Actually, Mr. Tirol makes praises the counter-cyclical provision that was introduced by the Bank of Spain in the year 2000. You say also, and the Ministry of Finance might like this, the Achilles heel of monetary union is the control of budget deficits, which I fully share, but I don't know whether French people or Spanish people in general believe really that controlling deficit is so key for monetary union.
Well, it's very hard to be. I mean, to be honest, it's very hard to control a budget deficit because there are so many ways of having a deficit. You can, I don't know about Spain again, but in France, you take some of the best brains in a generation, and you put them in the Ministry of Finance so that they can find very clever ways to disguise the budget deficits. And everybody does that. I mean, it's not only France. You know, I think municipalities do that. Many countries do that. They try to hide their debts by having off-balance sheet exposures. And so it's very hard to measure the debt because many of the things are contingent. So you have to say, is that a 1% probability or is that a 80% probability? How big is the risk, in a sense? And that's a value judgment at some point. And you know that very well. It's actually very complicated to compute. Second problem with the debt, of course, is that one size doesn't fit all. We know that some countries can have a large debt and they'll go bankrupt. If you think about Japan right now, You know, Japan has 240% GDP debt and is not bankrupt yet and is still borrowing at low rates. And part of the thing is that it has a fiscal capacity and also the debt is held in Japan, not abroad. Argentina went under with a very low debt, 60% of GDP. So it depends on many factors. You know, we economists are not very good at predicting when a country will default, but at least we are pretty good at saying, you know, here are the four or five factors which are going to increase the probability of default. But we have decided for political reason that the 60% number will be the same for every country in Europe because we didn't want to price discriminate. And then there was a political control, and I think that's what you have in mind, the political control of deficit. So basically, you had the Council of Finance Minister, basically, it's a small club, deciding among themselves if the others was virtuous. But, you know, if you are one finance minister and you say, hey, I think something goes wrong there in that country, you may not change the decision in the end. And furthermore, you know, your friend has become a foe. So, you know, it's difficult to enforce in that way. But now, what do you do to enforce budget discipline? If you have an independent budget office at the European level council, which is independent, then everybody will scream. How do you let a budget be decided by independent agencies? And you can see what, I can tell you what the reaction will be in France. I remember advocating an independent budget agency in 2008 in front of high officials in France, I'm not going to name them, and having a reaction which was indignation, basically. You know, people were so upset that I could even mention that. Of course, it took place a few years later because France had to accept that, but in the end, there's not much power in those independent budget councils. So it's actually a very difficult thing to do. But at this stage, you know, we are kind of midway in the European construction. So what do? You destroy Europe. I think it will be a terrible mistake. You try to patch things a little bit and hope that everything will go fine in the next few years until people realize what they should be doing. Or you move all the way to the end product, which is a federal state. But the federal state, I'm a federalist. But
it's plain from the book.
But I'm very worried about the possibility of having a federal state right now, because if you look at the U.S. is a federal state. It has a common currency, but also it has a number of laws and rules for all different states, and you have a better stabilization mechanism. It's done through the budget. It's done through investment too. That's because if California is doing poorly, then California will get money automatically from New York, for example, through the transfer, through lower taxes paid by Californian citizens and corporations, through investment too, because you know, the pension funds of Californian retirees or the savings of Californians are not invested in California. They're invested all over the place, in the U.S. in particular. So there's a lot of stabilization. But something I want to insist on as well is that in the U.S., you have common rules. By and large, I mean, there are state-level laws, of course, but, you know, you have common rules. If you think about Europe, you don't have that. Actually, you have a move toward more sovereignty all the time, except for the banking union, which is the exception. If you think, for example, and I like this example, would you like to have a common unemployment insurance? It will make sense. It will stabilize things. At the same time, all those countries in Northern Europe which have 5% unemployment will say, why are we going to pay for those countries in the South which have 20% unemployment rate? Now, if it was just a random shock, that would be fine. It would just be an insurance mechanism, and that would be perfectly fine. But if it's a systematic thing, and I believe that part of it is completely systematic, it's structural, the lack of reforms, then it cannot be the case. So the Germans, the Scandinavians, and so on, will never want to have some kind of scheme in which they will systematically subsidize bad employment policies in the South.
Mm. Well, as we need to talk about industrial policy, we are going to skip the very interesting chapter on finance and on the crisis. But I cannot help mentioning one funny remark that you make, because if one of your friends criticizes the international financial speculation against Greece and the refusal to lend money to the Greek government, he writes, ask him if he has invested his savings in Greek sovereign bonds. That's a very funny remark. Yeah. Sometimes people are inconsistent. They're very vocal against international banks and financial speculators, but then they put their savings in a domestic bank, but not in risky bonds.
Yeah, no, I think there's a lot of hypocrisy there about speculation. I mean, there are bad aspects to speculation, but, you know, denouncing the speculators is a little bit hypocritical, because we are all speculators, right? When we buy a house, we are speculators. When we put in, you know, in safe assets in our own country, we are speculators. We are betting on price movements or betting against price movements, and we should face it. I mean, you know, it's accusing, you know, the foreigners to speculate against a country is a little bit dangerous. And, you know, again, I don't want to get into the French election, but, you know, I can see in some state of nature on Sunday things happening with capital flight, immediate capital control, and I don't think the state of nature is going to prevail, but if this prevails, then no, that might have been a capital flight, capital control, the new president saying, you know, the foreigners are speculating against us and they are trying to squeeze us. I told you, those were the finance people, and they are harming France, and then using a special law in France, which allows you to take the full powers if the country is in danger, which de Gaulle did when there was a military putsch. That's the worst possible scenario. It's not going to happen, don't worry, but, you know, it's one of the things that you might end up with. But, you know, I think it's dangerous. People, they are not philanthropists. People in finance are not philanthropists. They go where they think the money is going to be profitable. But, you know, they're also a thermometer of our own policy. And we have to take that into account. So I think we have to regulate finance. And we haven't done that enough, obviously. But, you know, and the financial crisis, I think people have a good case of being upset about it in many countries. But at the same time, we should do the right thing, not just basically accuse, you know, scapegoats for what they are doing when we do the wrong policy.
Well, okay, let's take the few minutes that we have left to discuss competition, industrial policy, innovation, which are covering as many as five or six chapters in Jean Tirole's book. And you start by saying that even it's counterintuitive, competition increases employment. And how would you convince taxi drivers facing competition from Uber of that proposition? Because you devote a chapter of your book about Uber and the collaborative economy.
Okay, so I'm not saying I'm going to increase competition is going to increase their own business, but of course, if the taxi fares are cheaper, then of course more people will take the taxi. In France, only the rich people take the taxi, or maybe those who are actually working for a company or for the government, because it's reimbursed, and the others are not taking a taxi. It's too expensive. So if you lower the prices of taxi fares and you get a better service, then that will be good. There will be more employment because there will be more activity. Now, of course, there is a redistributive consequence, which is that the taxi people in France, and that's the politicians' fault, actually have some of them, not all of them, actually, some of them have paid for their medallion, for their license, and they have put basically their retirement saving in their job, which actually is a very bad idea, but for everyone, actually not only for taxi drivers. That's what they have done. And they have some reason to be upset as well. But blocking technological progress is not a good thing. What they should be doing, and that they've been doing, is just to ask for a level playing field, which is, you know, everybody has to pay for the same social security contribution, pay the same taxes, and so on. So that's fine. You know, we need a level playing field. Competition is about a level playing field. But that's not true that actually having more competition is going to reduce employment. It actually should actually make it easier for people to find a job.
Well, you are a well-known expert, if not the best expert in the world, on two-sided markets and multi-sided markets and platforms like Facebook, Amazon, and the like. And you mentioned that they pose challenges to regulators, competition regulators, because they're required to take a very different approach from the traditional one. And there's also a chicken and egg problem and a winner takes all effect. Why didn't you illustrate the audience on the peculiarities of these markets?
So a two-sided market is a market in which a platform like Google or Visa, MasterCard or Facebook is trying to attract multiple sides of the market. So Google is trying to attract advertiser and eyeballs. I'm sorry, we are called eyeballs. You know, we watch YouTube, we use the search engine. Visa is trying to attract or PayPal or whatever, are trying to attract both merchants and cardholders. Same thing with video game platform. They have to attract developers who are going to write games onto the platform and also attract people who are going to play with a console. So all those things are two-sided markets, and you have to balance the act so as to attract all sides on board, to get all sides on board. And those markets have grown very big. So if you think about three of the top five firms in the world are two-sided markets. Alphabet, Google, Apple, Microsoft. You take 7 out of the 10 biggest startup in the world, they are two-sided markets. And basically what industrial organization economists are trying to do is to try to understand how this works and how to develop the business model, because there is a regulatory side, but there also is a business model side. So the businesses also are all wondering about that. You know, from the small startup to the big bank, they have to think about those things. So they're trying to think how to get everybody together, in what sequence, and so on. Now, for the regulator, that creates new problems. So, for example, if you think about Google, for example. You, as a consumer, you get wonderful services for free. You watch YouTube, you use a wonderful search engine and Waze and so on. For free, way below cost, not way below marginal cost because the marginal cost is small, but way below any other notion of cost. If you have your Visa card in your pocket, hopefully, I don't know in Spain, but here, in many countries, your Visa card is going to be free. So you get a very nice payment service. You may even get frequent flyer miles and cashback bonuses. So it's way below cost again. And of course, those are not philanthropists. They get the money on the other side of the market. So advertisers pay a huge amount of money to Google or to Facebook or to whatever firms is. The merchant pay a merchant fee to Visa, MasterCard. They may be paying 3% to PayPal or other things. And of course, same thing with Booking.com, who is going to take a large share of the pie from hotels and airline or Expedia. And Uber is another example. Uber connects you to the taxi drivers and is taking 25% of the fee. So those are actually, this is a business model and that has been thought about both by economists and also by business strategies. But, you know, for the antitrust, I mean, there are some people who do antitrust here. You know, for the antitrust practitioner, it's complicated because we have learned that high prices are bad. They are not illegal, but they are bad, especially if they come from a merger or they come from some abuse of dominant position. But now you have those markets where, on one side, you have extremely high prices, like monopoly prices, and on the other side, you have below-cost pricing. So you might think there is monopoly pricing on one side and there is basically predation on the other side. But the problem with that, even small firms, which have no market power, have the same price structure. So you have to rethink your entire competition policy for that. And you know, many of us have been trying to convince antitrust authorities actually to consider the entire market together, so the both sides together, and not look at one side in isolation, because it doesn't make much sense. Because there is a deep connection between the two prices. If you lower the price for the merchant, for example, then you are going to raise the price for the consumer. If you control advertising, then maybe Google is going to start charging for the search engine and so on and so forth. So you have to take into account this relationship between the two prices to understand. But still, we have situations where those platforms very often are monopolies. They are monopolies because then what we call network externalities. I want to be on Facebook because you are on Facebook, not necessarily because Facebook is better than the competitor, but simply because, you know, we want to be on the same platform. Or, you know, we are going to use Google or Waze because there is more traffic, so that means that if I'm looking for a small, you know, an infrequent search, you know, this small restaurant that nobody searches for, I will find it on Google, but I won't find it on Bing. And same thing, if I try to compute how much time it will take me to go from here to the Prado, then, of course, Waze is better because Waze has more customers, so it can compute better estimates. And the difficulty, again, for the antitrust practitioner is that those monopolies have efficiency. They're actually efficient in some way, but then they have all the problems of monopolies. As also, they might, you know, not innovate, they might charge high prices, and all those things. So we have to invent new antitrust economies. We have started a bit doing that, but we, you know, this is now the new economy, and we have to actually be better at finding rules to regulate those firms.
Well, before we open the floor, my last question. Well, actually, it's not a question; it's a recommendation. It's for you to send a chapter you write on insurance to President Trump and to those discussing these days the repeal of the Affordable Care Act in the U.S. Because you actually write that information kills insurance, meaning genetic information on individuals, if known by insurance companies and by health providers, may lead them to make a very perverse selection, and those with medical conditions may be excluded from medical coverage. And then probably that's what's been discussed these days in the U.S. You make an extensive analysis of the issue, and that's why probably you should send the book to Mr. Trump.
I doubt somehow he will read my letter, but if you're telling me, I could try. No, it's a big issue, and with genetics and with also the the digital economy. So you know now Google knows everything about you, including your health, and you know this is because they read your emails, they read your searches, and all those things. So they actually know quite a lot about your. Not only about your taste, but also about your health. So all those things considered together, and also there are statistics, and it becomes cheaper and cheaper to make targeted offers. So, you know, I could have the list of people in this room and notice that the average risk in this room actually is a bit lower. So I make an offer, which is a nice offer to people who attended this meeting, knowing that I'm going to make money out of that because you are lower risk than the average person. But then, of course, that means that the others will pay a higher price. So we destroy insurance that way. Now, the systems which rely, the health system which rely on private insurance, like Switzerland or Germany or the Netherlands, actually prevent risk selection. And that's very important. That's very important because politicians always forget about this thing. And I could go into detail how this happens in France, where risk selection is forbidden. For the complementary insurance, but actually takes place. It's actually an issue, and you know, I think what's happening in the U.S. is shocking, you know, to be honest. I mean, there was an attempt by President Obama actually to improve things so that everybody would have a good coverage. If there is something in which there is very little more hazard, it's health. I mean, there's some, but very little. And we really have to cover people well. And, you know, it's one of the best redistributive instruments you can think of. You insure against the risk of genetics, the risk of health that we all face when we are born. And information destroys insurance. If you allow insurers to use information which are specific to people, they will make good offers to people who are healthy and terrible offers to people who are not. And then that we have to avoid.
Okay, my apologies for having suffered this severe case of embarras de choix. There were so many issues. I strongly recommend you to read the book. But before we open the floor, I think we should offer Mr. Tirole a round of applause.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.